the modern United States in demographic terms is very much a product, not exclusively, but certainly to a considerable extent, of emigration from the German Reich.
States and Migration in Europe podcast, welcome. Today we have a very special guest, Professor Brendan Sims from Cambridge, the author of a recent biography of Hitler, Hitler Only the World Was Enough. It's connected with our topic in this podcast, as Professor Sims has well shown in his biography of Hitler, how migration shaped Hitler's geopolitical thinking and explains a number of Hitler's actions. We will be discussing the history of immigration from Germany between the 18th to the early 20th century, how Hitler's concern about immigration shaped his geopolitical thinking, and the consequences of his attempts to manage migration. So, Brendan, thank you very much for being here. That's a great honor to have you in this podcast. How are you?
I'm very well, and thank you very much for asking me to join you.
Before we get starting, what drives your passion about this topic, and how did you come to study Hitler, German history, migration?
Well, I suppose you could say the study of history was in my blood, in the sense that my grandfather, who started his career as a civil servant in India, he was part of the Indian Civil Service, after India became independent, as a second career, he became an historian. So there were always a lot of books around the house. I inherited a lot of his books. So my mother, who's still alive, was a historical geographer in Dublin. So I grew up with historical geography as well as straightforward history. So that, as a career path, in a sense, I was following in the footsteps of my ancestors, you could say. And then there's the connections of family more generally, which I think you will find in almost any family, you'll have connections. So my German grandfather, so on my mother's side, fought in the Second World War, unfortunately, for him and everybody else. And there's the whole story around the flight of my German family from what then became the German Democratic Republic. And on my Irish side, family which spread across the continents, really. I mentioned India, but I've also had a great uncle in South Africa, a great great aunt in Canada, and so on and so forth. And there's nothing particularly special about that. That is really the story of the 20th and the 21st century, but it did help to animate my interest in history.
Mm-hmm. Yes, so we see well a family legacy that connects the study of history, a German connection, and also a quite intensive migration flows. So we have already started talking about German immigration with your grandfather. So let's delve a little bit into the topic of German immigration, maybe in until precisely the situation in which your grandfather left his Germany. So how important was immigration in German history from the 18th century until the beginning of the 20th century?
Well, extremely important, particularly from the early 19th century onwards. When Germans had been leaving for particularly North America, really since the start of the colonization of the continent. And they've been leaving for many different reasons, for religious reasons. So you'd, for example, Protestant Palatines fleeing persecution by Catholics, late 17th, early 18th century, for economic reasons and for political reasons. It's really the size of the migration which is critical. It's the German emigration is actually the largest immigration into the United States. We're talking about something like 6 million plus Germans who leave Germany between 1820 and 1914 and go to the United States. It's actually the biggest single influx in national terms into the U.S.
We were discussing this map together on the share of ancestry by county in the United States in 2010. And we can see very well on this map that German ancestry is the largest ancestry in the United States. We were trying to find older maps, but it seemed that these kind of maps started being designed by the US Census Bureau only recently, around 2000, most probably. Mm-hmm. And it's likely that if we were able to find a map from 1900 or 1920, precisely toward the time when Hitler started thinking about the smarts, it would have been even more dramatic. So does this kind of map match your perspective on German immigration and the role that German immigration played in US history and US immigration?
Yes, as you say, it's a very striking map. So it's a whole sea of red is the color chosen here. And as you say, were we to have had a comparable map for 1900 or 1910, that would be an even bigger field of color showing the predominance of German settlement. So there are whole states, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, and so on, which are completely dominated by German migration. It goes all the way across from the west to the east coast and from the north, not quite to the south, because you then get into predominantly African-American areas in terms of the relative majority of origin. But I think it does illustrate the point, which is that the modern United States in demographic terms is very much a product, not exclusively, but certainly to a considerable extent, of emigration from the German Reich.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And we have maybe a concrete example of those immigrants in the family of Donald Trump. Have you been working on his genealogy? No.
Yes. So I mean, the list of German Americans is long and in some cases distinguished and in some cases controversial. So one thinks, for example, of President Eisenhower. Of course, the commander of Allied force in Europe and subsequently president in the 1950s, who was the descendant of Mennonites, so religious refugees from Germany, if you like. But you're alluding to Donald Trump, whose grandfather, Friedrich Drumpf, emigrated in the late 19th century. In fact, he arrived at Ellis Island and was rechristened Frederick Trump. Donald Trump is very much also part of this great German migration. And it should be remarked that Donald Trump is pretty anti-German in his comments and outlook, and that is not at all unusual for the general trend of German-American political opinion, which really after the traumatic moment of 1917-1918, when the United States entered the First World War, many German Americans really broke with the old country at that point. So origins in Germany, German descent, is not in the same way a badge of honor or something you remark on that you might, for example, if you're an Irish American or of some other background.
Yes, that's particularly interesting. And here we start approaching what is your big argument in the book, and which is that, and it was also Hitler's perspective, as we shall see, that those German emigrants were somehow lost to Germany. So what you have just said, that this the cut took place somewhere around 1917 when the United States entered the war. But in contrast to British immigration, I understand that German immigration served to populate a territory that had no relationship whatsoever politically with Germany. Mm-hmm. Whereas even though the United States took independence from the United Kingdom, there were still extensive links between the two countries. And you also mentioned earlier the other parts of the Commonwealth. So German immigration occurred in territories where German political influence was absolutely absent. Do you think it can explain this, the fact that German immigration was lost to Germany? And what was the concern about this loss in German among German elites at the end of the 19th century, early 20th century?
Well, so I mentioned that we're talking about millions of immigrants. So there's a quantitative concern that, that Germany is just losing workforce, losing potential soldiers and recruits. But it's also a qualitative concern. There's a general agreement in the discourse, and Hitler, by the way, also was of this view, interestingly enough, which is that immigrants tend to be the most active and the most get-go, if you like, elements of the population. And so you have this sense, at least among some elements, and certainly on Hitler's side, that in a sense the best forces, the best demographic forces within Germany are hemorrhaging out of the country. And this was a phrase that was used at the time, and particularly also by Hitler, are fertilizing, so Dünger, sie liefern den Dünger, they provide the fertilizer for other countries. And of course, the United States is the main receptacle, but as you mentioned, the British Empire is also very important. So large numbers of Germans go to Australia. In fact, I had a great grandmother who was a German from Australia, who came to live in the West and then came back to Ireland, for instance. Or they went to Canada, or they went to some of them also New Zealand, South Africa, fewer. Most of them went to the United States. And so the concern is that these elements have been lost to the Reich. And it's quite an important theme in the Second Empire. So people like Paul Rohrbach, for example, who was a big enthusiast and propagandist for German imperial expansion, quite explicitly says that a major reason for this expansion is to provide Germany with colonies which can soak up the demographic overflow and prevent it from advantaging potential rivals of the German Reich. And indeed, there were, for example, in the 1920s, in a place like Munich, there were actually newspapers devoted to emigration. So it's a big theme. I mean, Germany, the bottom line is that Germany in the 19th and the early 20th century was basically an emigration country. It wasn't an immigration country. There was a net outflow rather than net inflow, which of course is something we don't really think of today, because we have a picture, quite rightly, of Germany as a country to which people went. But actually, in the time we're talking about, it was a country from which people emigrated.
Yeah, absolutely. And as we shall see, it's Hitler's attempt to fix this issue were not successful. As we can see on this graph, the preparedness to emigrate from Germany was quite high, even after the Second World War. Yeah, it's from 1948. Mm-hmm. We can see that almost 43% of men in West Berlin wanted to emigrate still in 1948. But one could make the argument also that, again, that the UK also experienced quite a significant amount of immigration. And for the UK, it was a way to project power, whereas for Germany, it seemed to be a way to lose power. So do you confirm that it has all to do with colonial institutions that made that once a country belonged nominally to the UK or to Germany, then its immigration would serve to reinforce the country of origin? Do you think this was something real, or this elite in the Second Reich may have overestimated this aspect? Do you think that they were really losing something? Mm. Or yes, is it 1917 that really made them lose those people?
No, I mean, they lost them, if you like, twice over. They lost them demographically in the 19th early 20th century, and then they lost them politically with the American entry into the First World War. And the way you can see this is if you look at the case of the British Empire. So you're quite right to say that there's a large outflow from the British Isles. And quite a bit of that, certainly on the Irish side, goes to the United States. But most of it goes to the British Empire and then is deployed, is retrieved, if you like, in the context of imperial war. So during the Boer War, for example, you have forces sent from Australia, from Canada. You read accounts of the Boer veterans, somebody like Dennis Raitt, for example, in his famous book Commander, he talks about how depressing it was, you know, that to find that every week a new troop ship would arrive from some part of the Commonwealth, bringing more and more people who'd signed up just to fight them in South Africa. And then, of course, when you come to the First World War, if you think of the contribution, particularly the Anzacs, the Australians and New Zealanders in Gallipoli fighting the Turks, but also often overlooked, there are plenty of Australians on the Western Front as well. Then you have the Canadians who basically, you know, fight the Battle of Vimy Ridge, Passchendaele. It's a huge input. So that, I think, was an example of how the demographic outflow then comes as a reverse flow back into Europe during the First World War. And of course, for the Germans, that reverse flow was hostile. And that was the thing that Hitler was really worried about.
Thank you very much for this this aspect on the role of the capacity of the UK to get those people back in certain circumstances. That's really highlights indeed how immigration could be lost for Germany and not for the UK. And this is where Hitler came of age, the environment in which he grew up. But maybe just before we delve into his geopolitical thinking, Hitler was an immigrant himself because he grew up in Austria and joined Germany. Did Hitler ever consider himself as an immigrant?
No, of course not. I mean, he regarded himself as a German. And in his mind, he was engaging in internal migration. So he was moving within the German space. And of course, he volunteered for the German Imperial Army, not for the Habsburg, Kaiserlich und Königlich Army in 1914. But you're right to say that his national and citizenship status was contested. I mean, he actually spent a period stateless, and he had some difficulties actually getting a German passport. But those are the, if you like, the formal bureaucratic facts. But in terms of his own self-understanding, he didn't consider himself an immigrant. He considered himself a German who had moved between different parts of what was Germany or what should be Germany.
Interesting. And so when reading your book, we see that Hitler really had a confrontation with this reality we were describing during World War I. There was an episode in which he came across US soldiers of German ancestry. What did the shock that revealed this predicament to Hitler?
Yes. So in July, the middle of July, to be precise, the 18th of July, 1918, Hitler comes across, or he takes prisoner two Americans who he drops off at brigade headquarters. And we know that this incident happened because we actually have the document from one of his commanders referring to it. It's in the Bavarian military archive in Munich. I was the one who actually found that document, which shows that you're always learning new things about Hitler. Why this is important is not so much the actual incident itself. It happened at the height of the Second Battle of the Marne, which was really the moment at which the Americans got involved in turning the tide in France towards the end of the First World War. But the reason why it's significant politically and geopolitically is because Hitler comes back to this incident on many occasions in the 1920s. Mm-hmm. What he says is that these two Americans, or what he claims, is that these two Americans were of German origin. And he refers to the moment in 1918 when the German armies on the Western Front encountered the children of emigrants from Germany. And he says they are blonde and blue-eyed, and they have returned to fight the fatherland. Now, whether they were blonde or blue-eyed, that we absolutely can't tell. But what is clear is that what had lodged itself in his mind was that he was now fighting the demographic outflow from Germany, which had come back as enemies of the Reich. And this causes him to question then Germany's foreign policy up to this point and to develop a whole strategy designed to deal with the problem.
Exactly like the British were able to gather from various parts of the empire soldiers to fight in the Boer War, the same was taking place in the First World War, of course, and but this time against Germany, and this were German emigrants fighting Germany. So Hitler was making this calculation, this strategic calculation in his mind at that time. That is, they leave the country and they come back to fight us. And moreover, as he was saying, the best come back to fight us. Mm-hmm. So he tried, so this is in this context and his experience during the First World War that he starts developing, I understand, his geopolitical thinking around the late teens and early 20s, he develops a geopolitical thinking. He starts looking east in order to solve this predicament.
Yeah, from Hitler's point of view, the real problem, or one of the problems, critical problems in Germany, but for our purposes here, the real problem, is that Germany lacked space. It lacked space because it hadn't developed an overseas empire in the 16th, 17th century, the moment when others, particularly the British, were doing that, were starting out on this path. And why was it not doing that? Because it was internally divided. It was fragmented through the Reformation, through the religious wars. And that fragmentation then, in his view, persists to the modern period. So it becomes a fragmentation not just around religion, but also around particularism, regional differences within Germany. It's a fragmentation around class, it's fragmentation around ideology, party movements, and so on. And so his view is that in order to survive, Germany is going to have to, in some way, imitate what the British and what the Americans have done. In other words, to secure a large amount of space, which enables your race to develop. So Hitler's view is that the German people are actually made up of several different racial elements, only one of which, the Nordic element, he considers to be truly superior. There are other elements, Slavic elements, Alpine elements, and so on. We're not talking here about Jews. We're not talking here about the so-called undesirables and those who have no right to live and so on. We're talking about those elements who are unquestionably part of the German nation, the German folk, the German people, but who are not, in fact, members of the Nordic race, which he thinks is, if you like, a cream on the top of the bottle. And the way in which you develop your racial quality can take different forms. It can be to do with cultural activity. It can be to do with other forms. But the main way you develop racially, in Hitler's view, is through territorial expansion and through war, through a constant process of engagement and strife. And this is what's happened, in his view, in the American West and with the British Empire in places like India, which had then enabled the development of what he calls the master race. So the only time I've ever found Hitler using the word master race myself was in the context of the British, the Anglo-Saxons, whom he considered to be the true master race. And so what you needed to do was to gain space to develop the race. And as you say, he decides to secure this space, to the east of Germany. He wasn't entirely sure at first about this. Like many people, I think he did flirt with the idea of overseas colonies. But for him, the experience of the First World War was that actually the British, the Royal Navy, will simply cut you off from your colonies. And anyway, that the world globally had been distributed. And therefore, what you needed was a large amount of space, which was contiguous with the German Reich. So you couldn't be cut off by the Royal Navy, and you could create a sufficiently large critical mass, which would enable you not to dominate the British and the Americans, but to become a viable co-equal project in the running of the world. That is what he wanted. And that is why he developed his so-called Lebensraum concept of territorial expansion in the East. So the reason why he fixates on the Soviet Union is not because the Jews, who are his ideological enemy and another form of racial enemy, are dominant there in the Bolshevik regime, but rather because Russia is weak, having a Bolshevik regime will render it vulnerable to the kind of takeover that he has in mind.
That's fascinating. Though Hitler was looking forward to territorial expansion both as a way to transfer there the surplus of population of Germany so that this surplus doesn't go elsewhere, and as a way also to improve the race. It was his view that it's in this process of expansion that the race is improved, correct?
Exactly right. So he conceives of, and he says this explicitly, he conceives of the territorial empire, this new territorial empire in Russia, in Ukraine, basically, and parts of Western Russia. He calls this, you know, this will be our Mississippi will be on the Volga. And he specifically says that he hopes that it will soak up the demographic overflow from Germany, perhaps also some elements from the Low Countries, from Holland, and also maybe some people returning from America, German Americans returning from the United States, although he's never really very optimistic about that. But he's conceiving of this space as something which is analogous to the colonization of the American West.
Hitler seemed to be quite informed about the history of Europe over the previous centuries, and this idea of the improvement of the race in the expansion reminds me of Frederick Jackson Turner. Hitler read him, but Turner did not really think in terms of race. It was more in terms of character. But was it kind of similar thought he was developing, but instead of applying it to culture and character, he would apply it to race?
So the problem with Hitler is, obviously among many problems, is that he relatively rarely cited a specific author. And so quite often you just have to infer from the context or the argumentation what the source might be. And this is done generally very, very well in the edition, for example, of Mein Kampf, published by the huge two-volume commentary and edition published by the Institute for Zeitgeschichte in Munich. So far as I'm aware, Frederick Jackson Turner was not among the influences that they had located. I certainly didn't see any reference. He does mention other Americans. So, for example, Madison Grant, who was an American racial theorist, wrote a book in 1916, notorious book, which was called The Passing of a Great Race. He does cite Madison Grant. And what's interesting is that he actually endorses Grant's view, which was controversial within Germany, that the Germans were probably not the best immigrant material into the United States. Grant's view was that the best immigrants came from the British Isles, and the Germans and the Scandinavians, but particularly the Germans, were a bit further down. And this caused quite considerable offense in German right-wing and racist circles. Hitler, interestingly enough, says that Madison Grant is right. which reflects, I think, Hitler's view that essentially of the superiority of the Anglo-Saxons. They're really the racial element which you're going to have to prevail against if you're going to survive in this competitive world of great powers.
Here I understand, we are talking about the early 1920s. This is approximately when these various thoughts settled down in Hitler's mind. And perhaps the spectacle of Russia, the Soviet Union, embroiled in a civil war, made it an attractive prey for Hitler's expansionist ambitions.
Yes, that's exactly right. And I think I need to stress here, of course, that anti-Semitism is very important to Hitler's worldview. I mean, we have been talking about emigration and Lebensraum and the geopolitics of all of that, which doesn't in every case directly involve the Jews. But I wouldn't want your viewers or listeners to come away thinking that we don't consider anti-Semitism very important. But what I think is true to say is that the anti-Semitism here is important, and it's in a different way. It's important as an anxiety around the domestic corruption and fragmentation of Germany, which is aggravating and to a certain extent causing, in Hitler's view, Germany's disadvantaged position within the world. But even without the Jews, he still has all the anxieties I've referred to with regard to emigration and the Anglo-Saxons. And he sees the Jews and Bolshevism not as a foreign policy threat. So his concern with the Soviet Union in the 1920s is not an invasion by the Red Army of the German Reich. What he's worried about is that internal subversion by communists and allegedly by Jews will render Germany defenseless against a takeover by the forces of international capitalism and the forces of the Entente of Britain and France and also the associated power, the United States. That's what he's worried about. And he gets territorially fixated on the Soviet Union because, as I say, he believes that Bolshevism has hollowed out the Soviet Union and in turn rendered it ripe for takeover by the Germans. So it's actually the weakness of the Bolshevik Soviet Union that is in his focus, not so much the military threat at this moment.
What we are doing here is trying to understand how the thread of the migration predicament shaped Hitler's overall geopolitical thinking, and it shaped it quite extensively, as we have just seen. Other aspects of his, it doesn't mean that it explains all the aspects of his mind. My opinion is that his hatred of the Jews went beyond that. There was probably something else also that triggered it, and you refer to that in the book as well. But let's keep our thread for now. And so we have seen how the predicament of emigration in Germany, how Hitler became aware of this predicament, and how this aspect shaped his overall geopolitical thinking somewhere until the early 1920s. Then let's fast forward until the 1930s, when Hitler really came to power and started implementing his strategy. So do you think that Hitler's attempt at conquest and at wars of subjugation, annexation, first in Poland and then later in the Ukraine, were really still driven by the previous considerations we have mentioned, namely finding settlement opportunities for Germans and forging the German race?
Very much so. And it's important, I think, to realize that the attack on Poland is not in the first instance a territorial demographic land grab. His initial hope had been that he could ally with Poland. Poland is generally conceived of by Hitler prior to September 9th, or let's say the summer of 1939, as a potential partner in the despoliation of the Soviet Union. And it's only when Poland refused to do that, as then guaranteed in March, April 1939, that Hitler then comes of the view that he needs to deal with the British and the French, and he needs to eliminate Poland on the way. So it will then be a staging ground for the attack on the Soviet Union. But the Lebensraum itself is to be seized in the Soviet Union, in Ukraine, and in Western Russia, not in Poland. That's the original conception. And when he implements this vision from late 1939 onwards, it is very much driven by the same motivations that drive him in the 1920s. In other words, he is contemplating the antipathy of the British Empire, the antipathy from October 1937 of President Roosevelt, who is, of course, has made the famous quarantine speech, bracketing the German Reich along with Mussolini's Italy and Imperial Japan as the enemy of civilization and of world peace. Hitler thinks, well, I now really have to speed up this process of territorial gain. And also, I need to secure the resources that will enable me to outlast the British blockade. And that's a very important part also of the attack of the Soviet Union in 1941. So the framing, the strategic framing around Operation Barbarossa is primarily around the securing of Lebensraum and the securing of raw materials and foodstuffs. The anti-Bolshevik element and the mass murder of the Jews, which follow, is part of the operational implementation of that plan. But you won't read anywhere in Mein Kampf or anywhere else in the 1920s that we need to invade the Soviet Union in order to eliminate the Jews. We need to invade the Soviet Union, he argues, in order to secure living space. That's the strategic objective.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, I was thinking in terms of time, because you were referring to the Volga, which will be the Mississippi River, to the expansion of the British Empire. These were developments that took centuries sometimes, or at least several decades. Yep. And so to what extent was Hitler trying to accelerate time in this process? And to what extent, that would be the counter-argument, was he still trying to have a massive robbery of resources, foodstuff, oil fields, in order to secure his back against the Anglo-Americans?
Well, the two are not mutually exclusive, of course, but you put your finger on a really important aspect, which is quite prominent in my book, which is the time factor. And Hitler's conception of time, actually, it oscillates. So there are moments in the 20s when he thinks that, in fact, he's not even going to take over power himself. He will simply be somebody who will be a kind of John the Baptist figure, a drummer, was the phrase he used and was used of him, that he would pave the way for some future messiah. Then he starts thinking, just before the 1923 coup, well, maybe I can do it. That, of course, fails. Then he goes to a longer timeline. There's a certain sense in the 1930s of, on the one hand, there's an urgency. On the other hand, he is arguing in terms of long-term transformations, and that you'll begin in Germany, you'll begin by improving the living standard, which is very important in his mind for improving so-called racial equality. And then when you come to the late 1930s, and as I say, the growing antipathy of the United States and the British Empire, he then speeds up. And this has a consequence for the racial policy, because you move from a more evolutionary a policy of excluding Jews to a more radical revolutionary policy of murder. And then on the living space front, you move them to speeding up the acquisition of living space. Time is very, very important. The less time Hitler thinks he has, the more radical his actions are. That's the general rule.
And indeed, and under this pressure of time, he faced serious disappointments in his attempt to manage migration. Though he was expecting that he would conquer territories and that this would take up the demographic surplus of Germany, perhaps bring back some of the German immigrants from North America. And this fails dramatically around 1940 until 1942. So there was this line that he thought he had a people without a space. He ended up with a space without a people. Can you elaborate on that?
Yes, so there are many different stories embraced by this general characterization, which you've just repeated, in the sense that he acquires a non-trivial number of Germans in the context of certain policy moves in 1939-1940. So, for instance, in 1939, he concludes an agreement with Mussolini over South Tyrol, where he basically says South Tyrol is going to be part of Italy, and the South Tyrolese Germans have to opt either to be Italians, in which case they should stop complaining, is Hitler's argument, or they can become Germans, in which case they have to, inverted commas, return to Germany. So he gets, 100,000 of South Tyrolians on the strength of that. Then, after the agreement with Stalin in the Hitler-Stalin Pact in August 1939, there are agreements for the, inverted commas, return of Germans from Volhynia, from the Baltic states and other places. So he has them. So he uses them to a large extent to put them in territories captured in Poland, which originally he hadn't actually been planning to settle. The Lebensraum, as I said, is really in Ukraine and Western Russia. So that is an attempted solution. The problem really is, first of all, that Germany, because it is now a war economy, suffers hugely from labor shortages. So there actually isn't a demographic overflow. Quite the opposite. There is a huge demand for labor. And it's a great irony that it's during the Second World War that Germany becomes, in fact, the greatest country of immigration for the first time. Of course, now it's even more so. But this inflow of slave workers and semi-voluntary workers and others, particularly from 1941-42 onwards, is quite important. And Hitler hadn't really foreseen that. The second factor is that being settled in Poland, or even worse from their point of view, in somewhere in Ukraine or in Crimea or whatever, is deeply unattractive to most Germans. This is not the life you would want to lead. Most people want to live in a large city and not to be exposed to partisan attacks and so on. So the settlement plan is a complete flop. It's a failure.
This pins down what was wrong in Hitler's approach to migration management. He did not manage to manage migration, actually. So why did people not want to go there? Whereas you could say they went to because it was, these were other times, it was no longer the time of the frontier in the United States. Why did it fail?
So, if we're asking what was wrong with Hitler's approach to migration, one is tempted, of course, to say, obviously, everything. Everything almost, well, pretty much everything Hitler does or says is in some sense wrong. We wouldn't want to be misunderstood as suggesting otherwise. But to answer your question within the sense in which you asked it, I think the problem is that yes, the generation of the 1940s is not like the generation of the 19th century, which is fleeing economic hardship, which is fleeing political persecution, but it's mainly economic. So the economic push factors in the German Reich in 1941 to 42, which is when this would have been relevant, are minuscule. People are paid relatively large wages. There's a shortage of labor, as I've said. German workers are a kind of aristocracy over the foreign workers. There is really absolutely no reason for anybody to take off from the big population centers of the Ruhr or Upper Silesia or whatever, and to go and live an arduous and hazardous life in Russia or in Ukraine. And if you're in a sort of poor and rural part of Germany, then you're more likely to move to one of those jobs in the war economy, in the population centers in Germany. Again, despite various incentives, you're unlikely to go east. So the incentive structure was just completely different from the migration flows of the 19th century.
Yeah, it shows the failure of the top-down management of migration flows, which moreover he conceived in terms of the economy of the 19th century, whereas in a more industrialized economy, less agricultural economy, with also some the development of major urban centers, the dynamic of migration flows was no longer the same as it used to be in the 19th century. And so his antiquated ideas and his forceful management of migration flows collapsed against this reality. And to what extent did it play a role in the ultimate collapse of Hitler's project?
Well, I think, you know, migration, in a sense, is his downfall, because he's beaten by the Anglo-Saxon powers. So he's experienced exactly the same thing as the German Reich has experienced in the First World War. So he wants to avoid Hitler, history repeating itself, but he actually brings on the very combination that he wants to avoid. And it's a great irony that a huge proportion of those coming, certainly from the United States, were of German descent. So I mentioned Eisenhower already, but think of the commander of the Air Force in Europe, General Spatz, was of German descent. And in the book, I give a long list of generals who are commanding in the Northwestern theater, fighting Germany. And Hitler himself is conscious of this. He refers on several occasions during the war to the fact that Germany is fighting its own emigrants, and indeed fighting its own engineers. It was a particularly remarkable incident in the summer of 1944, when, of course, the German war economy is producing at a very high level, but it's being clobbered by the Anglo-Americans from the air, and of course, it's being outproduced by the West as well. And Hitler says to the leaders of the German war economy, "I know you're very worried about all these German engineers working for the Americans, but don't worry, I have German engineers as well." Which would be a very strange comment if you didn't understand the context, which we've just been discussing, which is of this great outflow of German talent, which is now basically reinforcing and fueling the Allied war effort.
Yeah. All right. So we have completed the journey of Hitler's thinking about migration, and so I really encourage everybody who has not yet done it to read your book, which is a fascinating and innovative biography of Hitler, which shows how migration impacted his geopolitical thinking. So you managed to draft a book that is both very innovative and has also triggered significant debate among historians, and that has broad public appeal. As a historian, which advice would you give to to historians, to young historians especially, to combine these innovative aspects and also the broad public appeal of this narrative?
Well, I think if you're an academic historian, a young academic historian, what I would recommend is that one publishes the first book and possibly also the second book on a more narrowly defined traditional scholarly topic, so to establish your credentials as a scholar, and then move to something that might have a wider appeal to the public, but of course, you know, conducted according to the scholarly principles. And I think what you would do then is, what you need to do is to find a gap. You need to find a topic that will be of public interest, that is not every topic will be. And then you have to be lucky. You have to be lucky in terms of timing, perhaps. And you have to be skilled in the way in which you go about it. So an example I would cite, a book I like very much by my colleague Claire Jackson, who's an early modern historian of Britain. She published a book last year called, the year before last, called Devil Land. And it's about 17th century Britain and the travails of 17th century Britain. And it's, in many ways, it's a story which is rooted, obviously, in the century itself, about all the troubles with Scotland and Ireland and religion and so on. But what I think made the book so attractive and helps explain part of its success is that it's not merely an excellent work of history. It also seemed to explain to many people England, Britain's difficulties with Europe, difficulties with itself at a time of Brexit. So many of the stories that she told resonated with people's experience around Brexit. So, as I say, it's a question of timing. It's a question of contexts. And she'd have obviously herself also established herself as a scholarly historian of Britain before that. So that's the way I would suggest going about it. I wouldn't dive in immediately into an inverted commas popular book. I mean, it might work, but I think you're more likely to be successful if you take it at a gentler pace.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very, very interesting approach. And your book too does resonate with the present in the sense that it closes it closed an episode of migratory imperialism and led to a new period in which migration stopped being closely connected to imperialism as it used to be, and Hitler learned the hard way that he was closing the door of this historical period. So, Brendan Sims, thank you very much. It was a great honor to have you talk to us about this this fascinating question: the role of migration in Hitler's geopolitical thinking and his ultimate failure. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. Bye.